From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. It was once the coolest game. Now it's the coldest, too. Ahead on Only a Game, how hockey is filling frozen seats with frozen fannies. Also, a college football bowl roundup and preview. The NFL regular season winds down with zero, count 'em, zero undefeated teams. And the best American sports writing, 2009. Also ahead, the story of Delaware basketball standout Elena Deladon, who left number one ranked Connecticut to be with her sister.
Lizzie is deafblind. Like, the connection that I have with her is something that you really can't even explain. When I had to leave for Connecticut, I didn't realize how upset I was going to be, and I really couldn't leave her.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The FedEx Orange, the Papa John's, the fabled Eagle Bank, the Allstate Sugar, Chick-fil-A, and Brute Sun. Ah, we thank these mighty corporations for the bowls that bear their names. The Little Caesars, GMAC, Outback all make claims to entertain us, and perhaps they do so, though we'd fall into a witless stupor if we tried to watch them all. Here to discuss a few of this year's 34 bowl games is Greg Doyle of CBSSports.com. Greg, welcome back to Only a Game.
Yeah, and I'm always in a stupor. It works out well for me.
It's perfectly comfortable watching all these games. Florida went 12-1 under head coach Urban Meyer, who had an apparent heart attack about a month ago, admitted to covering that up, temporarily resigned, and then said instead he would take an indefinite leave of absence. Given that distraction and the hubbub around the last game of Florida All-American quarterback Tim Tebow, it's pretty remarkable that Florida won the Sugar Bowl, isn't it?
Yeah, but how else was this going to end? I mean, the Bible ends with Jesus rising from the dead. Tim Tebow's career was not going to end with Tim Tebow losing this game. So, yeah, he overcame Urban Meyer's massive distraction. I don't know how you could be any more distracting as a head coach than Urban Meyer was in the days leading up to the game, but Florida won.
Ohio State beat Oregon in yesterday's Rose Bowl. Are you surprised that everything came up roses for the Buckeyes?
Yeah, and it's about time. Usually they play a really good team in the bowl game and they get their rear ends kicked. And this year they got tired of getting kicked around. And Oregon doesn't quite match up to LSU and Florida and some of the teams that have beaten up on Ohio State in the past. But still, Oregon's pretty good. And usually Ohio State plays a pretty good team in the bowls and loses. So good for the Buckeyes for turning that thing around.
Yesterday's Gator Bowl saw Florida State defeat West Virginia 33-21 in Bobby Bowden's last game of a 50-year head coaching career. He must have been listening to Only a Game the last time you were on because he took your advice.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he was going to resign unless they pushed him out the door. But they did push, and he finally went. And I'm not sure, actually, when he knew the game was over, about a minute and a half left, he kind of left the field and walked over to the band and threw his hat up in there. And with most coaches, you'd say, well, he was just kind of relishing a victory. But when it comes to Bobby Bowden, maybe he thought the game was already over. I'm not really sentimental towards that guy, simply because he turned his job into a Supreme Court justice appointment, and he was going to have it until he died. He really thought he should coach forever.
Much of what we see in college bowl games is unsurprising, Greg, but we don't often see a coach suspended, then take his case to court, then get fired all in the same week, and hence lose the opportunity to coach his team in a bowl game. Any precedent for this that you can think of?
No, the Mike Leach situation at Texas Tech has blown me away, and this comes in a week where Urban Meyer resigns from Florida and then 12 hours later changes his mind, sort of. We're still not sure if he's resigned from Florida, and yet that's the second craziest coaching story of the week, the Mike Leach being the craziest story of the week, and right now there's no winners in that one. The kid that was told to go sit in the dark corner, Adam James, apparently is a little weenie. His dad, Craig James, the ESPN announcer, is apparently a helicopter father who hovers over the system. And then Mike Leach might very well be a really big, bad bully. So everybody loses, including Texas Tech, which hired Bob Knight despite the fact he choked the player, but is firing a football coach for sending a player to a dark room.
Which, if any, of the bowl games played before yesterday especially delighted or surprised you, Greg?
I loved the Texas and the Armed Forces Bowls. because you had Armed Force Academies winning those bowls. First of all, Armed Force Academies in any era shouldn't even be going to a bowl game, much less going to a bowl game and winning. But in this era where you've got an 18-year-old high school kid with any athletic ability at all, and he's got options, I assume, and he picks an Armed Force Academy where he could very well be and probably will be in a war in about 5 years and might die. And they're going to those academies anyway. It's a recruiting nightmare, and yet those, you know, Air Force and Navy both beat pretty good teams. Navy beat Missouri, and Air Force beat Houston, both of them by 3 touchdowns. Very impressive.
There are 9 bowl games remaining besides Thursday's BCS title game between No. 1 Texas and No. 2 Alabama. Is there any point in talking about any of those remaining 9? Come on, we're past New Year's Day.
Well, Boise State and TCU, you know, 2 undefeated teams, the 2 undefeated non-BCS teams, it's almost like if the NIT and college basketball had really good teams, you would want to pair the NIT winner against the NCAA basketball tournament winner and get a real national championship. So whoever wins that TCU-Boise State game is really going to have an argument that, hey, maybe we're the best team in college football, and it would be hard to say, no, you're not.
And it's an argument that under the present system will never be settled.
Never. That's why we got to have a playoff. It's just I hate playing the political card, but it's un-American to have the kind of nonsense we have around college football. We are a country where you just settle things right out in public, and now we settle these things with little Weasley voters behind closed doors.
All right, but given that we have the system that we have, who gets to claim the title this year?
Oh, Alabama, Texas winner, absolutely. I mean, the system is what it is. Now, the winner of that TCU-Boise State game will say, hey, what about us? And it'll be hard to tell them to shut up and go away. But if you're the Alabama-Texas winner, I mean, you know, the system says if you go to the BCS title game and win it, you are the champion. So that you are the champion. But, boy, if I'm TCU or Boise, I'm a little bit upset about it.
Greg Doyle covers college football and lots of other stuff for CBSSports.com, and he joins us from time to time here on Only Game as well. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you, Bill.
In the early days of hockey, children grabbed their sticks and skates and headed to the nearest indoor arena to play. Wait a minute, that's not right. The game of ice hockey began outdoors in the 1800s, and in the past decade, outdoor games have become much more common in the professional and college ranks. Only a Game's Doug Tribou reports.
Fenway Park has seen a lot of things since opening in 1912. College and pro football, soccer, and Harlem Globetrotters basketball, to name a few. But hockey wasn't one of them until yesterday. The National Hockey League staged its 2010 Winter Classic in Boston at the home of the Red Sox, with the Boston Bruins hosting the Philadelphia Flyers. Outside the park before the game, fans were getting ready for an unusual sports experience. Flyers fan Jay O'Brien traveled from Marlton, New Jersey for the game. He says Winter Classics are becoming one of the biggest sporting events of the year.
You don't see this too often. It's going to the Super Bowl for regular folks. It's a great opportunity. I'm looking forward to it.
Bruins fans Eric Thaler and Doug Kennedy of Winchester and North Falmouth, Massachusetts, respectively, say part of the attraction of the Winter Classic is that so many fans can relate to playing outdoors as kids.
So I think it's going to be a fun atmosphere. It just bring back those memories of playing outside in the snow until it just got dark.
Yeah.
And playing until you couldn't see the puck anymore.
Yeah.
Right.
Or you couldn't feel your feet, one or the other, right?
Inside Fenway Park, the red and blue of Red Sox baseball caps were replaced by the black and gold of Bruins winter hats. A typical indoor NHL game draws between 15 and 20,000 fans, but more than 38,000 were on hand to see the Bruins beat the Flyers 2-1 on a Marco Sturm overtime goal. Yesterday's game was the 3rd annual Winter Classic, but the NHL has experimented with playing outdoors before. In 1991, the New York Rangers and the Los Angeles Kings played an exhibition outside in Las Vegas. In 2003, the Oilers hosted Montreal in Edmonton for an outdoor game dubbed the Heritage Classic. But the recent explosion of outdoor hockey dates back to 2001, when Michigan State hosted Michigan at Spartan Stadium. Nearly 75,000 fans packed the football stadium in freezing and extremely windy conditions for the game better known as the Cold War. Adam Hall was on the Michigan State team and says coming out from the locker room and seeing the crowd was surreal.
As you kind of walk out of the tunnel, like it opens up more and more around you, and just the roar gets louder and louder, and right when you think it can't get any louder, it does.
Later this month, approximately 1,500 players from across the country will gather on Lake Nokomis in Minneapolis, Minnesota, for the fifth annual U.S. Pond Hockey Championships. Tournament founder Fred Haberman says fans and players' memories of small neighborhood games may be one reason pro and college outdoor games are getting so much attention.
People are looking for authenticity in their lives. I think they're looking for the purity of sport. There's something that happens when these players are playing outside that brings them back to their youth, and it's a powerful feeling.
Minor league hockey is about to get in on the act, too. The Syracuse Crunch of the American Hockey League will face the Binghamton Senators at the New York State Fairgrounds in Syracuse on February 20th. The Crunch are hoping to draw more than 21,000 fans, which would break the league attendance record. Crunch owner Howard Dahlgren says the game provides a unique opportunity for the city.
It's really a once-in-a-lifetime event, and in a community like Syracuse, where they're never going to host the Super Bowl, this is as big a single-day event as it gets. And it's a chance for Syracuse to show what a great sports market Syracuse is.
Many players would consider themselves lucky to get into one outdoor game. But after his experience at Michigan State in 2001, Adam Hall got another opportunity. Hall now plays for the Norfolk Admirals in the AHL. But in 2008, he was on the Pittsburgh Penguins team that played against the Sabres in Buffalo in the NHL's first Winter Classic. Hall says the wet snow falling throughout the game made it more picturesque, but also forced players to make adjustments.
When the snow builds up on the ice, it makes it that much more difficult to handle the puck and pass the puck quickly and make quick plays. So every single time the whistle was blown and the play stopped, they had to have people come out and shovel the ice, all the snow off the ice.
Hall's former Michigan State teammate Duncan Keith has also had the rare opportunity to play outdoors in college and the pros. Today, Keith is a member of the Blackhawks, and he played in the 2009 Winter Classic at Chicago's Wrigley Field. Keith says that game brought back a lot of childhood memories.
You don't get that chance anymore to go out in the outdoor rinks and play. And I can't say enough about how neat it is to skate out there and get those feelings back again.
The trend of staging games out in the cold is still hot. Next week, Fenway Park will host the first outdoor collegiate women's game when Northeastern University takes on the University of New Hampshire. Then the men's teams from Boston University and Boston College will face off. Next month, the University of Wisconsin will play Michigan at Camp Randall Stadium in Madison. Meanwhile, the NHL is already planning the 2011 Winter Classic, and league officials say they're considering adding a second outdoor game next season featuring two Canadian teams. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Attendance is compulsory. A missed airline connection is no excuse, and there will be consequences. Carlos Khemeini, the goalkeeper for Espanyol, Madrid's second most famous soccer team, discovered all of the above when he returned to the team from his Christmas break. Khemeini failed to arrive in time for Monday's practice. He was told to work out by himself on Wednesday, which doesn't sound so bad, but the punishment didn't end there. He'll not only have to train alone. Espanyol coach Mauricio Pochettino said he'll be buying an aperitif for the squad and the coaching staff. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, why basketball standout Elena Delladon ditched the vaunted Huskies and joined the relatively obscure Blue Hens. But first, here to discuss Week 17 of the NFL season is Yahoo Sports columnist Dan Wetzel. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
I suppose we should start with the AFC, where seven teams will be contending this weekend for a scant two postseason spots. Are you surprised that Pittsburgh hasn't found its way into a playoff position yet?
So the first question, you got to bring up one of my preseason Super Bowl selections. I see how it works, Bill.
At least we're consistent.
My other one was St. Louis, the Saints. They're doing well. We got to go right to Pittsburgh. I am surprised, obviously. I thought that they would handle the sort of post-Super Bowl hangover better because they had done this once before and had a bad year after they won the Super Bowl a few years back. The real issue, though, is Troy Polamalu, their great safety, has been injured out the last six games, and that's been their biggest struggle. They got a lot of work. They need to win, and I deserve an MBA for even having a cursory knowledge of how this tiebreakers work. They need a couple teams to lose. So even Mike Tomlin, Steelers coach this week, says he doesn't even know. What he just says, we got to win, and then something will happen. He's not even trying to figure it out. So if he doesn't figure it out, I don't feel like I need to. Steelers are in trouble.
All right, Baltimore is among the other teams in the AFC on the bubble. Also Miami, Jacksonville, Houston, Denver, and the New York Jets. Who does make it?
Well, I guess I'm going to go with the Jets. They get Cincinnati that I think is going to rest most of its players on Sunday night in the Meadowlands, the last game for the Jets in that stadium. They have a good defense, so I'm going to give the Jets the win and snag that last spot with everybody else watching at home begging for them to lose.
New England and Cincinnati have clinched playoff berths. They're each 10-5. Does either of these teams strike fear into the hearts of potential opponents?
Yeah, they do. Cincinnati can score. They really came from nowhere to have a great season, and they lost one of their players. Henry died earlier this year, and that's motivated them. So I think they're certainly a team that's a little dangerous because you don't know quite what they're going to be able to do. The Patriots will always scare people as long as Bill Belichick and Tom Brady and Randy Moss and Wes Welker are there.
Speaking of teams that may not be as scary as they look, the San Diego Chargers have a history of playoff disappointment. Should we expect more disappointment from them?
It's going to be really the question of the playoffs because the Chargers are playing probably better than the Colts. Even the Colts are 14-1 and very easily could be 15-0 right now. They've won 10 consecutive games. They've looked brilliant doing it. If they collapse this time, it will be another just incredible disappointment for the Chargers. This looks like a team that should have absolutely no problem at least getting to the game with Indianapolis in what would be just a huge clash in the AFC Championship. This is a terrific Chargers team, and no one is playing better football in the NFL than the Chargers right now.
The Indianapolis Colts were perhaps one controversial coaching decision away from an undefeated season. Do you think the Colts head coach Jim Caldwell was wrong to pull his starting offense in the middle of the third quarter of last week's loss to the Jets?
You know, in football terms, in under his reasoning, maybe not. He wanted to make sure his guys don't get hurt. He just wants to keep them sharp in these last couple weeks. But in terms of overall, absolutely. I mean, this was kind of an assault to the integrity of the game. There was no reason to pull Peyton Manning and most of his starters. They basically gave the game away to the Jets. They could have won handily, but Manning took the right stance as usual, said it's coach's decision. What do the players really think? Is there a hangover on this? Does it affect what they think of Caldwell? I doubt it because I think that locker room is sitting there saying, all right, we lost our chance at the perfection, which we wanted. We can still win a Super Bowl here. There's no time to pout. So I don't think there'll be lingering effects, but you never know.
Dan, I've heard that some fans occasionally bet on professional football games. I wonder, should coaches disclose their intentions to play the scrubs rather than the starters by, say, Tuesday, so fans won't be misled?
Well, quite interestingly, he did say what he was going to do. And the opening line on that game, and I was checking for entertainment purposes only, was the Jets getting 7 points. If you ever want to know why Vegas does not allow you to have a cell phone in a sports book, it's because instantaneously information like this pops out. At a press conference, Caldwell said, we're probably going to sit our guys in the second half. The line dropped immediately from 7 points to 3 points to the Jets. The Jets ended up winning outright and obviously covering. But why did he disclose it? You know, Jim Caldwell was an economic stimulus plan all by himself.
Speaking of undefeated seasons not to be, the New Orleans Saints have lost two games in a row. Maybe their canonization was a little premature.
Definitely. But that offense is fantastic. They have home field advantage for the playoffs. They're going to get to play in the very loud, very intimidating Superdome. They lost to Tampa Bay last week. Tampa Bay won its third game. This would be the biggest upset in the NFL all year. Tampa Bay is terrible. The Saints are very good. So I don't think they're really trying right now at full effort. They're not focused on it. I think the Saints will be fine when they get to the playoffs.
Looking at the NFC standings yields little tension and drama. Basically, Philadelphia, Arizona, Dallas, and Minnesota jostling for first-round buys. This is not exactly what the NFL or fans want the last week of the regular season, is it?
The AFC's got all the drama. The only interest in the NFC is what happens to the Vikings. They've lost three of their four games in December. Brett Favre has been alternatively terrible and great in the middle of games. He's had a public and a private, and who knows how, still simmering feud with his coach. That's probably the story of the NFC, because the Vikings last week had an opportunity to still win home field advantage, and now they may end up not even getting a first-round bye. Philadelphia controls its own destiny, although they have to play a really good Cowboy team.
So which of the weekend's games besides Philadelphia-Dallas are you likely to be watching?
I think it's going to be Philadelphia-Dallas is a terrific game. I want to see what the Vikings do. You hope to see some kind of pulse out of them. Favre has had a terrible history in December and in the playoffs the last few years. They're playing the Giants this week. I'm interested to watch that game. Houston has got a chance to jam their way into the playoffs. They have to beat New England. It's really one of the bigger games in the history of the Houston Texans. I'd like to see what their effort level is against New England.
Dan Wetzel is a columnist for YahooSports.com, and he joins me from time to time on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Dan, and Happy New Year.
Thanks, Bill. You too.
From the time she was in grade school, Elena Deladon was expected to do great things on the basketball court. Deladon helped her high school team win four state championships in Delaware through 2008. She signed up to play big-time college ball for Connecticut, and then, seemingly out of nowhere, she quit. Deladon took a year off from the game. Now she's back on the court, but playing for her hometown team, as Joel Rose reports.
The women's basketball team at the University of Delaware hasn't been a big draw lately. But this year, the team's home opener in December was packed. And it's safe to say that most of the 3,000 people in the stands were there for the same reason I was.
Going to a lot of women's basketball games here?
Not really.
It's your first one?
Yeah. See you later, Delaware.
She's awesome. She's the smoothest basketball player I've ever seen play. And for a big girl, she can sure shoot the three. Excellent passer in addition.
Delaware women's basketball has got this many people in the whole season last year.
Elena Deladon is 6'5", with blue eyes and long blonde hair like Gwyneth Paltrow's, and a game like LeBron James. By halftime, Deladon had 16 points as Delaware opened up an 8-point lead against Navy. Elena Deladon has played some big games at the Bob Carpenter Center before. This is where she won four state high school championships at Ursuline Academy in Wilmington. Deladon says she wasn't even old enough to drive when big-time college coaches started showing up at her games.
You would see them in the stands, and they always had their colors on. So if Tennessee would be wearing their bright orange and everything like that. So that was really exciting. At first, I was nervous, but then I got used to it and just realized that they were really just there to support me and show that they were interested. It wasn't like if I miss this shot, they're going to stop recruiting me.
Elena is a phenomenon, and she has been a phenomenon in Delaware since she was an eighth grader.
Kevin Tresolini covers college sports for the News Journal in Wilmington, Delaware, the paper of record in a state with less than 1 million people.
She's a draw. She's one of those first-name people. Just got to say Elena, and most people know who we're talking about. You know, this is a girl who, her junior year in high school, made 80 straight free throws to set a national record. She's a girl who, as a sophomore in high school, scored 50 points in this building, which nobody has done at the high school or the college level in this building.
By her senior year, Deladon was the National High School Player of the Year. She was recruited by all of the top programs in the country. Deladon signed up to play for National Powerhouse Connecticut. But in the end, she only spent about 48 hours in stores before driving back to Delaware in the middle of the night. At the time, Deladon said she was burned out and that basketball had become like work for her.
I blame the sport of basketball for taking me away from home, and it made me hate the sport. And I thought, maybe since I've been playing this my whole life, I'm just tired of it and don't want to do it anymore.
Now Deladon says she was mostly just homesick. She moved back to Delaware and took a year off from basketball. She spent a lot of time with her family, especially her older sister, Lizzie.
Lizzie is deafblind. Like, the connection that I have with her is something that you really can't even explain. And it's a connection we have without speaking a word to each other. So when I had to leave for Connecticut, I didn't realize how upset I was going to be. And it really tore me apart to have to leave Lizzie. So when I got to Connecticut, I realized I'm not even going to be able to stay in contact with her or see her much because it's too hard for her to travel. So even being home, I see now how much Lizzie meant to me growing up and that I really couldn't leave her.
Back home in Delaware, Deladon decided to give basketball another try. Her new coach, Tina Martin, is glad to have her, though Martin says she never pressured Deladon to come back to the sport.
Elena needed that time, and I certainly wasn't going to try to pursue her or recruit her. Now, there are a lot of people, a lot of fans and people that were, you know, coming up to me every single day and saying, are you talking to her? Are you recruiting her? You know, what does she say? And I'm like, no, no, and no, because I just felt that out of respect for Elena and out of respect for her family, they needed that time.
Deladon's decision to leave Connecticut for the hinterlands of college basketball generated lots of news coverage, but Martin thinks it's really not such a big deal.
She's just a young lady that family and family values are very, very important to her. And just like millions of other people, she made the choice to stay closer to home. And it just so happens that she was the number one player in the country that made that choice. And so everybody's, you know, blown it pretty much out of proportion.
After a year away from basketball, Deladon admits she's still adjusting to the speed and intensity of the college game.
There was some rust there and everything like that, and I hadn't played a game for a really long time, so to be back in a game setting was kind of different, but I feel like I'm getting used to it again and playing my way back into it. I'm just happy to be back playing where I belong.
Delaware hung on to beat Navy by 67-50 in its home opener behind a game-high 26 points from Elena Deladon. Delaware coach Tina Martin acknowledged that the girls looked a little nervous at first.
I knew that was going to happen. I was just hoping that we didn't give them some big lead in the first, like, 2-3 minutes because our kids haven't seen a crowd like this. We've had, like, 1,500, you know, 1,300 when we played other teams on the road, but we haven't had a 3,000 crowd yet, and it was just really nice to have them on our side. Once the kids hit a groove, this could be a lot of fun.
In basketball terms, Deladon is still a freshman. She's hoping to lead the team back to the NCAA tournament for the first time in 3 years. She also talks about wanting to play in the 2012 Olympics. But after her first home game of the season, Deladon was just savoring the win.
We had a great crowd tonight, and it just felt awesome to be back home. And with me, I really feel like I'm at home. I love this court, and I can't wait to play further games here.
After the game, Elena Deladon stayed for over an hour, signing autographs, laughing, and smiling. Her parents were there, and so was her older sister, Lizzie. One thing Deladon did not look was burned out. For Only a Game, I'm Joel Rose.
Last week's show included a selection of what we considered the stories you'd enjoy hearing again, our way of giving everybody at Only a Game a little time off during the holidays. Elizabeth Sweetman was one of the listeners who appreciated our including in that program my conversation with author Mark Barrowcliffe, who wrote a book titled The Elfish Gene about his youthful obsession with such games as Dungeons and Dragons. I have never laughed so hard while listening to your show, Ms. Sweetman wrote. I found a copy of The Elfish Gene and was able to enjoy it more from hearing the author's voice. Great interview. Another of the stories we reprised involved Ron Chambers, the Marine who had served in Vietnam and then decades later returned to the country to play golf. My conversation with Mr. Chambers moved Dr. David Warren, a retired Army major, to email Only a Game. They will beat their swords into plowshares, he wrote, and their guns and napalm into golf clubs and courses. The mental and moral strength of that Marine to return to Vietnam in peace is an awe-inspiring thing to hear. Could any story bring home the waste of that domino theory war more than the image of a Marine yelling "4" over those once deadly battlegrounds? Charlie Pierce came in for some criticism, good-natured as it turned out, for mispronouncing the last name of a star football player at the University of Nebraska, Dum Yu Kong Su. A big Bronx cheer and boo rhymes with Sue to Charlie Pierce, wrote a listener named C. Jones, who hears the program on KIOS in, where else, Omaha. Come on, Charlie, he continued. Learn to pronounce the name of the first player in college football history to win the Lombardi, Outland, Bednarik, and Nagurski Awards. Haven't you heard of how Memorial Stadium rocks to the sound of what appear to be boos each time Sue is in on a play? We aren't shouting boo, but Sue. And finally, old favorite George Carter, legendary youth hockey coach with teams of mites, midgets, squirts, and amoebas throughout the hub of hockey, called after his beloved Bruins had won a game, an event that not only inspired optimism, but set George to reminiscing.
I'm dreaming of a cup Christmas with Cheesy Dokey and Old Hodge. I can't think of another word that rhymes because they had no guy named Lodge. And I'm hoping that the cup is coming soon, yeah.
It went on, that message did, and I listened to almost all of it. You too can leave a message by calling the listener line, 617-353-1860. You can also reach us via our website, onlyagame.org, or you can write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Scooby-Dooby-Doo, where are you? We got some work to do now.
There may have been some growling, perhaps even some snarling and barking on the Texas A&M campus this week. On Tuesday, the American Kennel Club announced Reveille, A&M's canine mascot, had finished second in a contest designed to designate a favorite dog drawn from television, film, literature, sports, and art. Nearly 76,000 online voters participated in the contest, which saw Reveille edged by Snoopy, the iconic Peanuts character famous for sleeping on top of his doghouse and battling the Red Baron. Though Reveille is no doubt dismayed at being edged out by a cartoon character, the second-place finisher can take solace from finishing ahead of the song "Who Let the Dogs Out?", the painting of dogs playing poker, and Scooby-Doo.
I know, catch that feeling.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, catching up on some of the year's best sports stories. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news and perhaps a comment or two regarding the old year's news as well. Charlie, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Bill, and Happy New Year to everybody, to the entire Only a Game sports team, which includes you out there by your radios.
Yes, because without them,
we are nothing.
Exactly.
And I'm not a heck of a lot right now anyway, so...
A great many bowl games have occurred, I'm told. More will follow. Have you a favorite among the ones you've already seen?
Actually, the best bowl game I didn't see and wish I had seen was Oklahoma and Stanford, because not only was it a really good game, but Toby Gerhart of Stanford, one of the serious Heisman contenders, had a terrific game. Of course, I think the most remarkable thing, and I would love for one of our college football mavens out there on the general Only a Game sports team to pick this up. When was the last time two service academies both won bowl games on the same day?
You're asking me.
I'm asking the universe, of which you are only a small and, in this case, very ignorant part. When was the last time two service, Navy and Air Force, both won their bowl games? Mm-hmm. Air Force, in doing so, made Houston's Case Keenum into about a fifth-round draft pick. Our tax dollars at work very strenuously this week.
Later today, Texas Tech will face Michigan State in the Alamo Bowl. Mm-hmm. And on Monday, Texas Tech suspended head coach Mike Leach for mistreating one of his players, Adam James. The following day, Coach Leach filed a restraining order. And then on Wednesday, he was fired. And on Thursday, a trainer backed up the coach with a rather strange rebuttal. Have I got this about right?
Yeah, things are getting a little nutty here in Lubbock. And the player, of course, was Adam James, the son of Craig James, who is an ESPN analyst. And it has something to do with his recovering from a concussion, and they put him in a dark room. Apparently, he was placed in a sports medicine garage. I don't even want to think about what that is. But also, they put him in the media room. Don't put the poor kid in the media room.
No.
The accumulated bad vibes would hinder anyone's recovery. You know, it's very funny. This, of course, the university, which was so quick on the trigger with Mike Leach, is the university that actively sought out Bob Knight after he choked one of his players.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I find it very hard to sympathize with either side in this. I think if this is an object lesson to coaches that they don't necessarily have to be sadistic morons to coach college football, it's all to the good.
This week, an Associated Press review of admissions data indicated that at most of the 120 schools in college football's top tier, athletes, quote, enjoy strikingly better odds of having admissions requirements bent in their behalf. Can this be true?
I am shocked, shocked to learn this.
The
really?
AP is right on the job.
Would the AP like to do a historical review on this? Yes. I mean, there's a James Thurber story, and he's been dead for an awfully long time, about a guy named Balentsiewicz at Ohio State who had to name one mode of transportation to be eligible for that week's game and had everybody in his class making train noises around him. Looking out over this story, it's easy to see why the Associated Press is flat on its back.
I'm sure you'll be glad to hear that the week's biggest mystery has been solved. Patriots quarterback Tom Brady says that he will play in tomorrow's game against the Texans, even though the Pats have clinched their playoff spot. Whew, that's a relief, huh?
Yeah, he'll play maybe two quarters. Houston really needs this game. And in an ordinary context, if this was the middle of October, this would be a very intriguing football game. I think that Bill Belichick will give Tom Brady enough reps, as the current cliche goes, to make him feel like he's played in the actual game and then get him the hell out of there as fast as possible.
Speaking of coaches who rest their first-string players for the playoffs, how would you feel about Peyton Manning leaving the Colts-Jets game last weekend if back in September you had bet that the Colts would go undefeated?
How would I feel? I'd feel approximately the way Peyton Manning obviously felt coming out of that game. I've never seen anybody who was obviously so unwilling to take off his helmet on the sideline because if he loosened the chin strap, he might be tempted to talk. This was an act of towering consumer fraud by the Indianapolis Colts, and the entire NFL should be ashamed of it.
The Dallas Cowboys have decided that special teams coach Joe DeCamillis is deserving of becoming the fourth man in league history to receive the Special Courage Award. DeCamillis broke his neck during the collapse of the team's indoor practice facility back in May, but did not miss a practice while recovering from that injury. I'm wondering if the Special Courage Award should be renamed the Please Don't Sue Us Award.
Well, I think you'd have to be awfully cynical to say that, Bill, and I'm going to give it about 2 seconds, and I'm going to say exactly the same thing. But good for DeCamillis. Not only did he have this broken neck, but last week he was rushed to the hospital for an emergency appendectomy, and while he was in the operating room, the doctors fixed a hernia they didn't know he had.
Charlie, you and I know that arguments between players can become heated in NBA locker rooms and elsewhere, but do you think the Washington Wizards might want to look into installing metal detectors after Gilbert Arenas and Javaris Crittenden's Christmas Eve dispute over a gambling debt?
Yeah, we really shouldn't have guys carrying guns in the locker room. They shouldn't be having guys draw on each other, and they certainly shouldn't be having guys drawing guns on each other in the locker room over gambling debts!
It's just...
Come on, men!
It makes me sort of wonder how many NBA players are packing heat when they go to work.
Get with the marketing program. It's not good.
Tiger Woods has lost another major sponsor, Charlie. AT&T announced on Thursday that their logo will no longer be adorning Tiger's golf bag. Since Mr. Woods is taking a, quote, indefinite leave from the sport, I suppose we can expect more of this sort of thing.
You can never underestimate the essential cowardice of a major American public corporation. Nike is hanging on because they know as well as I do that the first time Tiger Woods wins a major tournament, most of this will disappear down the memory hole again. The interesting thing, of course, is that he was always the host of the AT&T National. He will not be the host this year, obviously, AT&T says, because he's taking the indefinite leave of golf. The next shoe to drop may well be American Express. We'll have to see on that.
Charlie, as you look back at the past year, can you think of an athlete who has not been sufficiently appreciated? Because if so, here's your opportunity to right that wrong.
Well, I think that the person who I insufficiently appreciated until the very end of the year was Ndamukong Suh of Nebraska. Number one, because he's probably the best college football player at his position I've seen in 5 years. Secondly, his father is from Cameroon. His mother is from Jamaica. Third, his first name means House of Spears. How did I miss this guy at Nebraska for this long?
And you pronounced his name right this time, Suh.
I took a run at it. I really did. But House of Spears? How can you go wrong being named House of Spears? How did I miss that?
And finally, Charlie 2009's world champion liar has been crowned. The Burlington Liars Club bestowed top honors on Larry Legro for his quip, which was deemed both clever and topical. What was Mr. Legro's lie, and how do you like the judge's choice?
Well, first of all, let's admit right here that Sarah Palin was not eligible because this was an amateur competition. But this is Mr. And I will dispute the judge's decision on this, by the way. This is Mr.
The letters.
This is Mr. Legro's of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, by the way. This is his winning lie.
Mm-hmm.
I just realized how bad the economy really is. I recently bought a new toaster oven, and as a complimentary gift, I was given a bank. That's not a lie. That's a vaudeville joke. I bought a toaster oven, and as a gift, they gave me the bank. But seriously, folks, it's great to be back here in Sun Prairie.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He's got a pretty good stand-up act, too, I think. Anyway, you see her each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill, and I'll be here all year.
If you'd like to leave a comment about something you heard on Only a Game, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. The cover of the 2009 edition of The Best American Sports Writing features a snowboarder who appears to be sailing over multiple mountains, and it's perhaps an apt image, as for some years now, the entries in this annual collection have been known to soar above the sports writing pack. Joining me now to discuss 2009's bests are Glenn Stout, who's been the series editor since 1991. Glenn, welcome back to the program.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
And I'm joined in the studio by Lee Montville, the guest editor for this year's book. Lee, good to have you here again.
Good to be here.
Just for the fun of it, I want to start with a mention of a story set in a traditional sport, Matthew Teague's profile of Philadelphia Phillies manager Charlie Manuel, titled Inside the Mind of a Genius. Glenn, each year there are a lot of profiles of managers and coaches. Why this one?
Well, this one, I think when Matthew wrote it, it was a counterattack about Charlie Manuel, because at that point, Charlie Manuel was being laughed at as being, you know, a bit of a hayseed in the sport. And then, sure enough, in the wake of the story, the Phillies win the World Series. Now, I suppose if you want to fast forward up a year, you might you might go, well, then again. But nevertheless, I think it shows us a side of Charlie Manuel that you otherwise would not be aware of. This is a man who, like, is actually, you know, lived in Japan. He's quite urbane, quite knowledgeable about baseball, and does truly love the sport.
Lee, I wanted to start with that story set in a traditional sport because there are so many stories in this volume that aren't set in a traditional sport, or so it seemed to me. Was that intentional?
No, I was just looking for the best writing, actually. You get this box full of stuff from Vermont, you know, in an old Nike shoebox.
Sure.
And then you kind of read through it. And the traditional seems to me locked into that day-to-day thing, you know. Are we going to trade for Curtis Grandison tomorrow, you know? Whereas other sports kind of lend themselves to writing better, I think.
Glenn, maybe I should have asked you that question first, because you are the guy who reads all the potential entries and makes the initial cut down to 80. Were there more impressive stories this time around about sports other than the ones that we tend to see represented on TV in primetime?
You know, I'm not sure if there were or not, but I will say this. I think that there's a tiddlywink championship going on in Burlington next week. Somebody's going to write a story about it. And, you know, that would not have been the case 20 years ago.
I got a call the other day from Bob Ryan, the venerable Boston Globe and ESPN columnist, and he said, I think I'm still in the record books. He says, I think I wrote the last on-deadline story that was in the best sports story series. and it was from 2003 on the seventh game of the World Series. And he said, I bet there'll never be another On Deadline story.
I wouldn't say never, but I think it's, you know, that's a real challenge. Not so much that a story like that couldn't make the book, but the stories like that aren't being written.
I ask this question of the guest editor every year, and each year I look forward to the answer. As you read the submissions, which one first had you saying to yourself, ah, well, whatever else happens, this one's in?
Probably the one that has that great lead about, I forget the exact thing, on the day he was going to have his leg cut off, he decided he really wanted to go running, you know. I mean, how could you not read that? You know, shoot me, I'm dead if I don't read that.
That's the first story in the book, and that lead is the reason why it's the first story in the book.
That first one, by the way, is called Life and Limb by Bruce Barcutt from Runner's World. For the record, that lead reads, on the day he decided to pay a man to cut off his leg with a power saw, Tom White woke up with a powerful yearning to run. I feel guilty laughing at that because it's a pretty gruesome image. But, yeah, it's quite a lead.
Yeah, and I mean, the rest of that story goes on to fulfill that promise mm-hmm. fully, I think, too. Mm-hmm.
I was a little surprised by the inclusion of Ambi Burfoot's story about the 1968 Boston Marathon. Lee, do you have a soft spot for former runners looking back over their shoulders?
Well, I went to work at the Boston Globe in 1968. One of the first things I covered was Ambi Burfoot winning the Boston Marathon. And I've always thought it was great that he went into writing. You know, it's hard to be a writer. There's a bunch of guys that become color men. And kind of say that was a tremendous play by a tremendous guy under a tremendous coach, but there are very few guys that actually can write coherent sentences, and he's one of them, and he brings us into the feelings of winning that so long ago very well.
Glenn, I'm going to ask you to look forward regarding another question. How many articles about Tiger Woods do you suppose you'll be receiving over the next few months?
Too many.
Well,
I say that, but I'm actually serious about it. It sort of reminds me of, you know, a number of years ago when Magic Johnson was first diagnosed with AIDS, and I got everybody's take on Magic Johnson. Not any of them necessarily very memorable. The memorable story about Tiger Woods may not appear next year. That might be a story that'll appear 5 or 6 years down the road. I think the memorable stories about Magic happened several years after the fact. It's one of those things where I think sometimes it has to percolate and process for a while. But everyone will give it their shot, and I'm not gonna turn them all down. But let me tell you, the lead better be really good.
Yeah.
On the day he decided to have his leg cut off with a chainsaw,
Tiger Woods decided to call up a girlfriend,
but he couldn't figure out which one.
There's a great story in here about Jack Nicklaus, a father bear by Wright Thompson. That story, to me, brought in a whole other aspect of Jack Nicklaus than we'd ever seen, how really businesslike he was, how he doesn't want to play golf. It was a true, true story, and maybe the Tiger Woods story, like Glenn says, won't come for 40 years. Mm. 40 years from
Looking
now,
back.
He'll be able to look back.
To wrap this up, I want to ask both of you about a question that comes up in the introduction to Best American Sports Writing 2009. Lee, you write regarding perhaps the near future, quote, will there be sports writers? What did you have in mind with that question?
I think sports writing has become like an endangered species, like we're the last blacksmiths still working. You know, there's a couple of horse tracks and a few farms, but that's about it. Everything now, it seems to be for the moment, without a lot of knowledge, you know? I mean, everyone is just blabbing about it and giving their 2 cents worth. And I sometimes wonder if that is just going to overtake the entire business, that reporting will kind of go out the window, that the for-the-moment story will just be the only story.
Glenn, any worries that we're all engaged in a dying endeavor?
Well, I mean, I share the same worry, but I also see kind of what comes out the other side, and that is that there's a lot of people who maybe aren't coming through the newspaper experience, and some of them are learning on the fly, but there's also a lot of really inventive work being done. And I think the work that stands out, even if it's coming from non-traditional sources, are from those people that learn that, you know, reporting is the basis for everything, that it's not enough just to sit back and opine on a subject, that you really have to report on it, you really have to do some thinking, and you really have to be inventive in the way you write about it. So I'm putting my faith in the continuing creativity of the writer.
Glenn Stout is the series editor of Houghton Mifflin's annual volume, Best American Sports Writing. Glenn, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks again, Bill.
And Lee Montville is the guest editor of the 2009 edition of the book. Lee, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Parati. We had help this week from Chris Albertine at Vermont Public Radio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or view our photo galleries, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. To share your opinions about stories you've heard on Only a Game and to get behind-the-scenes information about the show, you can visit our Facebook and Twitter pages, username Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from U.S. Pond Hockey Championships founder Fred Haberman, who lets us in on a trade secret.
When we had 12,000 spectators or 20,000 spectators in a given year, the beer consumption remained the same, which helped us to extrapolate that the hockey players are doing most of the drinking.
Let's hope that those beers were kept nice and warm. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.